Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 244. Stories of the Middle Passage with Jungian analyst Dr. James Hollis. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The second half of life is not so much the chronological moment of, say, becoming over 35 or over 40. It's when a person begins to say in a very radical and very sort of sober, considered way, so what's going on here? What is my life about? What are the agencies within me that are making choices for me? What is it that I need to do that, you know, needs to make changes in my life and so forth? And it's at that point a person may begin to sort of walk out from underneath the umbrella that has hovered over one's head, metaphorically speaking, that defines oneself and defines the roles and the decisions that one has made.
That was the voice of my guest, noted Jungian analyst Dr. James Hollis, discussing the psychology of the second half of life, and in particular, the stories to which we are in service, whether we know it or not. James Hollis, Ph.D., is a Zurich-trained Jungian analyst in private practice in Houston, Texas, where he is also the director of the Jungian Studies doctoral program of Saybrook University of San Francisco. He's the author of 13 books, including Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life and What Matters Most, Living a More Considered Life. Dr. Hollis is also executive director of the Jung Educational Center of Houston. He is also senior training analyst for the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, was the first director of training of the Philadelphia Jung Institute, and is vice president of the Philemon Foundation, which is dedicated to the publication of the complete works of Jung, including Jung's Red Book. Now, here's the interview. Dr. James Hollis, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
I am so happy to have you on the show. I've been interviewing a number of Jungians of late, including Jerry Rule and Monica Wickman. So you can hear.
Thank you for being persistent.
Yes, well, thanks for being patient. and I screwed up the dates a couple of times, misunderstood. But I'm glad that we were humanities for 26 years, having been a professor myself. And you did that before going to Zurich to get trained as an analyst.
Yes. Well, I found that the study of the humanities, literature, religion, philosophy, the arts, history, was as good a preparation for psychology as anything else. And they are, after all, explorations of the human condition and reflected a great deal of insight into them. And so I think there's hardly a case that I've seen or an issue, a complex, whatever, that one couldn't find a manifestation in literature, demonstrating it and dramatizing it, and often in a very profound way. But I did find in my life in academia, as much as I valued it, always the remaining questions, so where did that come from in us, and what's that about really? And, you know, the essence of depth psychology is becoming aware that it's not about what it's about. It's often about, what's really stirred beneath, or what are the hidden agendas that are in service here, so that many of our behaviors that we've grown accustomed to or rationalized or whatever are really coming from quite a different place in our psychological history. So I felt the study of the humanities was not complete without also taking on, the idea of depth psychology to work with the unconscious. And as you know, the problem with the unconscious is it's unconscious. So we literally do not know what it is until somehow we and find a way to track it back from the visible, tangible, observable world into the invisible places from which it comes in our behaviors and so forth.
Well, that background in the humanities certainly is valuable, not for only for psychology generally, but I think for becoming a Jungian analyst in particular. It's clear that that was not a wasted effort, given the wonderful literary references in your writing. I've been reading your book, The Middle Passage, From Misery to Meaning in Midlife, and you pose an excellent set of questions in the preface, which I think will provide an excellent set of bones for this interview.
Okay.
And also, I'd like to invite you to illustrate along the way with any stories or myths that help to illustrate or deepen our understanding of the journey.
Certainly.
Yeah. So first, let me ask you, why midlife seems to be such a popular topic among Jungian authors? I'm thinking not only of you, but also Murray Stein and Jerry Ruhl and probably others.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, so much of our early life is devoted to ego development, and that's necessary. And by ego development, I mean having a sense of who we are and what our capacities are, and the necessity of developing enough strength to be able to meet people halfway in relationships, to say, hire me, I can do that job, and trust me, I can meet you halfway in this relationship, and so forth. And, if we're run over by a truck on our 35th birthday or our 40th, we might say, well, the person lived a productive life according to the standards of his or her time and place, fulfilled certain roles that we consider appropriate to adults and so forth. But, so much of our life is really governed by the nature of the messages that we acquired in the family of origin. Some of them are conscious messages, some of them are not conscious, and we're much more in service to them than we think we are. Every young person leaving home thinks, well, I'm going to avoid the mistakes of my parents, and I'm going to choose the right partner and the right career and that sort of thing, and sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't, and the issue of personal authority, namely, what is my truth, and how do I stay in touch with it, and how do I make decisions that are going to, in the long run, be consistent with my own nature, in the context in which I have to make those choices. You know, we're influenced by social, economic, political factors around us, but I think what Jung suggested in an essay he wrote a long time ago, The Two Stages of Life, he said, you know, after you've served the biological and social functions of life, why are we still here? In 1900, the average mortality rate in North America was 47. So it didn't mean everybody died at 47. It just meant that beyond 47, you were outliving the statistical possibilities. Today, it's in the 80s, and we'd have to say, so what is that second half of life about, and in service to what? And Jung's answer to that was, well, the first half of life, again, not speaking so much chronologically as psychologically, is a social agenda. You know, again, developing ego strength and creating a life of some kind. And then the second half, he said, opens the possibility of, you know, the spiritual questions. You know, what are my values, really? I mean, what are the ones that I choose from all of those that are presented to me? Why do I choose them? And what are the kinds of qualitative decisions I need to make about relationship, career, and so forth? And these sorts of questions really require a person recovering a sense of personal authority. And by that I mean, you know, from the many voices coming at me and the many different ways in which one can be influenced, which threads there are mine, and do I have the courage to risk them, to live them in the world? Can I mobilize the resources necessary to carry them through? These are different kinds of agendas.
Yeah, you know, generally when I hear midlife, at least in the past, before reading your book, I think 35, 40, maybe somewhere in that range. But one of the things that struck me in your book that you point out is that the middle passage can happen at almost any age, and that, as you've suggested, it's driven not by chronos or objective time, but by kairos, which has more to do with a ripening. Do I have that right?
Certainly, certainly. And, you know, the presenting venue is sometimes a marital conflict, sometimes it's a depression, sometimes it's a problem with substances, Sometimes one wakes up at 3 a.m. and says, well, who am I really and what's my life about? And sometimes it's in the face of an illness or a child departing or a change in one's work life. I mean, the precipitant can be highly varied and the situation be different. But the thing that's in common is that everybody has at some point to say, you know, is the map that I've been living with matching the terrain in which I'm living? And if it isn't, you know, how do I evolve or move to a different map? And again, the second half of life is not so much the chronological moment of, say, becoming over 35 or over 40. It's when a person begins to say in a very radical and very sort of sober, considered way, so what's going on here? What is my life about? What are the agencies within me that are making choices for me? What is it that I need to do that, you know, needs to make changes in my life and so forth? And it's at that point a person may begin to sort of walk out from underneath the umbrella that has hovered over one's head, metaphorically speaking, that defines oneself and defines the roles and the decisions that one has made. To say, you know, a question I would always ask people, to what degree is the, you know, unlived life of your mother playing out in your life? Are you stuck at the same place? Are you trying to compensate for that? Don't think it's not playing a role. And how is the unlived life of your father playing out in your life? It's going to be there. And that has to do with someone else's life, but you've also internalized that as primal message about who you are and what your life's about. And to what degree, you know, is this playing a role in your life? And if we don't ask a question like that, and normally we wouldn't just sort of wake up and ask it, but something has to trigger that.
You suggest that generally there's some kind of anxiety or depression or discomfort that's pressing up and driving a person to begin to ask these kinds of questions. And they may be 25, or you even gave the example of somebody at 65.
Absolutely. Yes, and, you know, just take depression, for example. I mean, there are biological sources of depression. There are depressions that are reactive to outer loss and so forth, which are, you know, triggered in a different way. But then when we recognize most of us carry pockets of depression at good parts of our life, we'd have to say, all right, literally depression is something pushed down. It's pressed down. You know, what areas of my life have not been lived or are perhaps blocked by certain complexes, some fears, that sort of thing? A question I've asked in workshops, literally on four continents in the past, is where do you feel stuck in your life? And interestingly enough, when I've asked questions in workshops before, people almost always ask about, you know, what does that question mean? And can you give me examples? And no one has ever in four continents asked me, what does that question mean? Everybody intuitively has been able quickly to go to the place that says, well, I'm stuck here. This is a stuck place for me. And, you know, it stands to reason that if I know I'm stuck at some place, I can presumably get unstuck, but it doesn't work that way. And, yeah, typically, you know, those are the kinds of places where one is really summoned to a different kind of accountability for one's journey and a questioning of what's really going on here.
Do we all have stuck places?
Well, I think we do. Mm-hmm. Certainly we do. Places where we are lacking example or permission. In other words, I work primarily with people in the second half of life, and I would say every one of them has an accomplished life by outer standards, and yet most lack an elemental permission to be who they are. To feel what I feel, desire what I want, to really feel that I can risk being who I am. And part of that is the legacy of learning early in life, well, if I am who I am and if I pursue the values that are really important for me, it gets costly in the world. You know, I risk the disapproval of others, the loss of consensual support. I could even risk exile or misunderstanding or whatever. And so we hedge our bets and we become our own oppressors at times. And you can be sure in those places in our life where that's the case, we will, A, be stuck, and, B, we will often have pockets of depression.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly cop to both of those on my journey. And what you're saying really speaks to one of the questions in your preface, which was, how do we acquire our original sense of self. Is there more that you could say about that?
Well, you know, we acquire our original sense of self. Now, the key word there is sense of self, how we think or feel or believe about ourselves, both consciously and sort of unconsciously. It's an assemblage of behaviors, of attitudes towards ourselves and others, and reflexive responses that has two basic motives, anxiety management and getting our needs met as best we can. And we set these in motion as children when we're disempowered and dependent and vulnerable. And many times the behaviors there that get some modest success or adaptation get locked in. And so we will have, for example, areas where we are conflict avoidant, which is perfectly understandable for a child, or areas where we run and hide, or areas where we are aggressive and domineering in trying to get our needs met, or places where we wind up trading away our integrity and in service to getting along and accommodation and that.
So how do we redefine that sense of self? You know, it gets established early on, but then it gets revised.
Well, I think what happens is that our psyche, which is really a word for our the totality of our being, has its own opinion. And the paradox is, as therapists, as you know, people don't drop in to talk to us because they're in the neighborhood and would like to have a chat. It's because something's hurting. And part of the task of looking at things psychologically, say, why has this symptom come? And rather than simply say, how quickly do I get rid of it, we could ask, why has it come? What does it want from me? What is this suggesting? Why this depression? Why this anxiety disorder? Why this addiction? Why has this come? Now, it sounds simple-minded as I describe it in the abstract, but usually that's sort of the last place we would look. Usually what happens is we try to kick in our older behaviors and management systems, and things get worse. It's like being in a hole, and the only tool we have is a shovel in our hands, and you say, well, I better work harder, and the hole gets deeper. And it's at that point people say, you know, I really need to go talk to this stranger about that. I mean, that's kind of an abnormal conversation when you think about it. You go to a stranger, you pay the money, and you talk about your personal life.
Right.
And people get to that point because their other systems are not working.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's always with a sense of humiliation or failure or confusion or anxiety. And, you know, frankly, it's the beginning of wisdom, because it's an invitation to say, all right, what changes need to be made in my life? What new attitudes or behaviors or risks am I being called to make?
You know, you point out that one of the things that we're struggling with in terms of the identity that we've taken on, that there are these cultural, not only familial determinants or influences, but also cultural ones. And
certainly,
there was a line, and I was reading my wife's book, so she said I couldn't underline it. So I may not get it quite right, but I think you said that our culture suffers from materialism, consumerism, and narcissism with a few computer skills thrown in, and I love that. Did I get the right three things there?
Well, I think so. That's a pretty good list. In other words, you know, what we have to offer people on a collective basis is the fantasy that the material life will make you happy or will provide satisfaction. And it only does to a very limited extent. I mean, if materialism really worked for us as individuals and as a culture, we'd know by now, because we've certainly had the greatest abundance in human history. And we have a culture of distraction that helps us sort of distract from a conversation with ourselves. This in itself is not new. In the 17th century, the mathematician of Blaise Pascal said, culture has invented the jester, because even the king, if he think of self, may grow miserable. So we invent the jester to distract the king from reflecting upon himself. And he said, so our whole culture has become a diversion from self-awareness. Now, this is someone writing, centuries ago. And how much have we further escalated the notion of a culture that's wired in with so-called reality shows and distractions of spectacles of all kinds? And what's the point? You know, it somehow distracts one from an encounter with oneself. And then you see that can veer off into narcissism. And you know, self-investigation is not narcissism. It's actually, you know, can call one to some sort of painful places and ultimately says, all right, what really do my behaviors need to be in service to? And I think ultimately the notion of psychological health is to find that which is worthy of serving, because if we're spending our life simply acquiring more of something, we're certainly sacrificing our vital energies and our soul on behalf of something that's not going to pay off for him.
I was very interested in your discussion of narcissism in the book, and you raised the question, because many people would look at Buddhist meditation or Jungian analysis as belly button gazing, I guess is the phrase. And you pose the question, well, what's the relationship between Jung's concept of individuation and our commitment to others?
Yeah. Well, you see, ultimately, individuation is not individualism. It's about, as I was just suggesting, service. You know, what are you going to really serve? What are the values that will, in the long run, prove most rewarding? And for you as a therapist, I'm sure that part of that has to do with, you know, times when you feel tired or sad or depressed or whatever, and yet the work that you do is meaningful. And it's a work that you feel at the same time energized by. And you feel, most of all, the payoff is its meaning. It's not easy work, but it is a meaningful work. And the day it ceases to be meaningful is the time one should be looking in the other direction. And so I don't use the word happiness very often. I think happiness is a transient state and very ephemeral. And pursuing happiness on a constant basis, I think, is going to trivialize one's life and distract it. I think it's a matter of question of, am I experiencing, you know, my relationships, my work, etc., in meaningful ways? And if we are experiencing it meaningfully, then from time to time we'll be flooded with that emotion we call happiness. And it'll come from a sense that the investment of our energies is coming back to us in a way that provides satisfaction. And it's not necessarily an easy path, but it is a path that is anything but narcissism. Because narcissism is simply trying, you know, narcissism arises out of our core insecurity. You know, the narcissist, the story about the narcissist who says, you know, well, now enough about me. Tell me now, what do you think about me? I mean, what that really reveals is a profound personal insecurity. And narcissists try to persuade us that they really feel good about themselves when in fact they don't, which is why they wind up trying to solicit approval, affection, and honor from others. And, you know, in some way we're on to the secret of the narcissist. And so individuation is anything but narcissism. It's saying, really, I'm here with my life energies. How am I going to spend them in a way that in the long run feels most rewarding and which provides a sense of, again, of satisfaction? And that will lead one often in places other than the comfortable zone. In fact, I think one of the measures of our life is if comfort is the priority, it will wind up being a trivialized life. We have to move to places that are uncomfortable because those are the places that are challenging that will bring about growth and development in us. That, you know, we grow from challenge. We grow from taking something on. There's a wonderful line in the Prague poet Rilke who said once, our task is to be continuously defeated by ever larger things.
Well,
my youthful ego says, what's this defeat business? I plan to be in charge of my life. I plan to win. But you see, his whole point is, if we're taking on ever larger things, then it's a life of growth, of development. And that's the reward in itself.
Now, you talked about our commitment to others, but I also seem to recall that you even said that can be called into question at times, that maybe a person has made some kind of an early, somewhat compulsive decision to be of service, and that may not be where their authenticity lies.
No. I mean, there has to be some balance between service to self as well, because in the end, again, this is not selfish. This is what I bring to the table. This is what I bring to my partner. This is what I bring to my children. This is what I bring to committees I serve on. This is what I bring to my society. In other words, it's not selfish to bring a more evolved, more conscious, more accountable person to relationship. And I can't do that by living mindlessly or simply on automatic pilot. It requires a measure of reflectivity and a willingness to change and to critique ourselves. And again, the paradox is, from the standpoint of deaf psychology, the human psyche is continuously making its commentary. And being psychological doesn't mean being in control and manipulating our life, as our psychologies often fantasize. It's actually saying, what do I have to learn from the psyche? Which is one of the reasons why, for example, we would pay attention to dreams, because the ego does not create dreams, but sleep research tells us that we tend to dream as much as 6 times per night, times 7 nights, that's 42 a week, and nobody remembers that many, but there's a lot of activity there. And nature doesn't seem to waste energy. There are purposes in those dreams. And so if one is able and willing to track the motifs that emerge in those dreams, then one will see over time that there is a connection with a deeper source of wisdom, something, you know, I have to say, you know, it is my dream, so it's come from some place in me, but I didn't make it up consciously, so it's not coming from the conscious part of me. And to have the thought that there might be some other part of me that is wise, knowing, and invested in my well-being and seeking to solicit my attention, I think begins to lead one in a different direction and is the source of developing a personal authority after all.
I'm really glad you brought up the topic of dreams, because I'm in a dream group. I've been keeping a dream journal off and on for about 30 years or more, and and taught classes on dreams. So let's talk a bit about dreams both in and out of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, they go on every night, even though we don't remember them. And I found that when people are in therapy and they've been specifically asked to pay attention, they begin remembering many more. Again, there's no guarantee. We can go a week or two with no recollection, but then suddenly there they are. They're flooding one. And again, it's about tracking over time what the motifs mean. It's not so much, for example, if I dreamt tonight that I'm moving to Toledo, I wouldn't advise anybody to sell their house and move to Toledo. You could get there, and that shows you moving to Detroit. It's more important to say, what does it mean that something in me wants to move? What does that metaphor mean? We have an ego tendency to tend to literalize these things. That's one reason why most of the dream books out there are not very useful. So much depends on the life context of the individual dreamer, and more particularly, his or her associations with specific images. So if you dreamt of your grandmother this evening and I dreamt of my grandmother, it's not the same grandmother. You know, you can say there may be certain universal or archetypal dimensions to the grandmother experience, but on the other hand, we've had a different qualitative experience with different kinds of associations, and so it's important to realize the individuality, the uniqueness of the dream to each dreamer, and to respect that difference, to say the real interpretation arises out of the dreamer and out of the dreamer's associations. Now, it's something we can do on our own, but it's also good to have an objective other there to ask certain leading questions and to raise some issues, because we can be so swimming in our own psychology of the moment or our own complexes that we will view something through a particular lens. I remember many years ago when I returned from training in Zurich, I was doing a dream group in another part of the country. And we met every 2 weeks, and there were 8 in the group, so people took turns, and we would meet for 2 hours, so we would agree in general to spend about an hour on each person's dream and try to rotate and so forth. And one of our members spent an enormous amount of time interpreting her dreams and would write an essay that was very thoughtful with a lot of research on the various images, and would come in and read her essay. And the first couple of times that happened, we thought, well, that sort of takes care of that, doesn't it? Because she was so conscientious and dedicated in her research and sort of providing the final word. And then the third time, someone said, but, you know, I didn't see that particular dream about this. I saw it from a completely different way. And she suddenly expressed an enormous amount of anxiety on the spot. And it was like suddenly the jig was up. One realized, okay, what she was doing was on the one hand entering a dream group, which is an effort to listen, and on the other hand saying, but I want to stay in control of the material. And so the essays were really unwitting or unconscious efforts not to listen, but to stay in control and say, this is what it's about. I understand this. I'm in charge here. And when someone offered quite a contradictory point of view and began to explore some of the shadow issues in that person's life, it was very troubling and very disconcerting. And I think that indicated that we need sometimes the other to provide that degree of distancing and objectivity that allows us to approach the dream from another standpoint. Because ultimately, this work is humbling. It's not meant to make us feel great about ourselves. It's rather to introduce a more authentic dialogue. And out of that, we can come to a more realistic and authentic relationship to ourselves and our journey. And often that's humbling.
I know that you've written another book. I have a copy of it and wasn't able to spend as much time with it as I would like. Mythogems is the title, which kind of suggests to me myth and mythology. And so myth, in a sense, is a bigger dream, right? A cultural dream or something that we can look at similarly.
Yes, as Joseph Campbell put it, he said that a myth is really the collective dream of the tribe.
Yes.
In other words, it's a dramatization of what are their values. And in traditional cultures throughout the Western world and the Eastern world, it was clear that the tribal council understood the difference between what they called big dreams and little dreams. Little dreams were personal, but big dreams were those that had a larger energy to them. And it was the moral duty of the dreamer to come and tell the story or tell the dream to village elders or the shaman or whomever, because it was understood as a message to the tribe. Now, you could also say that the dream of the individual is his or her personal myth. And I'm using myth in a very neutral to positive sense of the word. Myth is really the dramatization of values. And in myths, both conscious and unconscious, you really are seeing what moves people and what really directs their lives. And so, the book Mythologems was really based on... Mythologem really means a mythic motif or archetypal pattern. And among other things there, I was talking about the psychological role that the idea of mother plays in both a personal level and a cultural level, the idea of the father, and what do we mean by the archetype of the child. And when we talk about the child, we need to recognize that within each of us, there's a whole kindergarten there. There's the needy child, the greedy child, the acting out child, the sullen child, the terrified child, and so forth. And in any given moment, that sort of needy, infantile part of us may show up in our behaviors, or the child is also the possibility of futurity, of spontaneity, of creativity. And, the question is, what aspect of the child archetype is showing up in a person's life at any given moment?
Now, we don't sit around the campfire and tell stories in the way that we used to anymore. To what extent do you think creations, somewhat conscious creations like films, let's say, mm-hmm. play that role? Do you think they do, or have
to a degree? Yes. No, it's clear that in ancient cultures, story was the primary vehicle of cultural transmission of because you see, the purpose of myth is to link us to four orders of mystery. The first is the mystery of the cosmos. Why are we here? Who are the gods? What is this journey about? Where do we go when we die? Those are universal and timeless questions. And a person or a culture is well served when he or she has stories or images which help link him or her in a felt and moved way, and is in trouble or bereft when that's missing. The second order of mystery is the mystery of nature. We are natural creatures, but we live in an environment in which living harmoniously is critical, our ecological crisis that is growing to be larger and larger for our Western world, is a symbol of something that's, you know, really out of joint and dislocated with regard to living with nature. Thirdly is the mystery of society and of relationship. Who is my tribe? Who are my people? What are the rights, duties, privileges that come with being a member of this group? And what are the responsibilities and accountabilities for that? The mystery of interpersonal and intimate relationship, too. And what are the images we have available to us? And then fourthly is the mystery of the individual. Who am I? What is my journey? What's the nature of my soul's journey about? And again, if you remove the stories that once spoke to individual tribes or cultures, then an individual is thrown back upon himself or herself and or the resources of the culture. And then we're in trouble because you realize so much of our culture, as I said, is driven by the fuelant of materialism and distraction and so forth. But that's not to say that there aren't living images that speak to us. There are pieces of music that speak to us. There are movies that speak to us. There are novels that speak to us, etc. And why? Because there are, you know, ways in which one can, the creative imagination does embody these mysteries in modern form. And, you know, we would have to say that at some level, what we call psychotherapy was a late 19th century, early 20th century invention, which hadn't existed before because it didn't need to be. That by and large, one went to the village shaman, the village priest, the local tribe for the answers to those orders of mystery. And as those sources became less and less satisfying to larger numbers of people, one had to invent, you know, another way in which one could bring one's individual questions and individual journey to the fore. There was a short story written by Franz Kafka in the second decade of the last century called A Country Doctor, in which a village doctor around the turn of the century is summoned to a patient in a small village. And he gets to the village, and the patient is there in a bed. It's a young man, and he's surrounded by the whole village. And the patient says to the doctor, "Save me, save me." And the doctor gives him an exam, and he says, "I can find nothing wrong with you. You seem fine." And the young man says again, with a growing sense of desperation, "Save me, save me." And the doctor examines him again, and this time Kafka describes it like a huge rose rising out of the chest of this patient. He realizes it's a symbolic wound. It's like a soul wound. And the doctor says, I can't help you. I don't know anything about this. And at this point, the villagers there get very angry at the doctor, and they strip his clothing off as a symbol of divesting him of his powers and sort of fling him out into the darkness. And at the end of the story, he's trying to make his way through the darkness and a gathering snowstorm to get back to his own home and saying, that's the way these villagers are today. He said they used to call the priest in his black gown, and when he couldn't save them, he said they called me, the doctor, in my white gown, and when I can't save them, this is what happens. And you think, why would Kafka have written that story somewhere maybe around 1915, 1920, in that area, except the recognition of many, many individuals that they could not particularly turn to the village shaman or the local tribal authority for the answers to questions that had maybe satisfied their ancestors, but they had to look elsewhere. And the sort of invention of popular culture with its distractions, its addictions, and its seductions are offered up as an alternative. And the question is, if they work, fine, but for most people, they don't. And that's how they wind up suffering some psychopathology, depression, an addiction, or wind up in our office to look it over more consciously.
Well, I love that Kafka story that you shared. I was not aware of that story. And I know there are many in the field of psychology that really try to anchor its history and its meaning in terms of science. But I've long felt kind of as you've articulated, that our roots really lie more in the shamanic.
Well, I think what we all need is a good story. And by story, I mean images that come to us that are consistent with our inner reality. And when we have that, when we feel that, we will feel connected, linked. We will feel a confirmation of identity. And when we don't, we suffer that. And so, Jung put it once in a letter. He said, many moderns fell off the roof of the medieval cathedral into the abyss of the self. And it's a very dramatic metaphor talking about, the tremendous isolation that people feel.
Yes.
I remember in, I believe it was Esquire magazine, about 25, 30 years ago, there was a story that I thought was brilliantly done. And it was just a fellow sitting in an apartment, presumably in Manhattan. And he had on three of the late night television shows. At the time, it was Jack Parr or Johnny Carson, and Merv Griffin was one, and I forget the other one. And so, when these television hosts would introduce another celebrity, the fellow there would talk with them like they were all sitting in the same living room together. You realize this was his community. These were his friends. And then he'd pause for a commercial and he'd switch to the other channel and he'd jump in with that conversation. And then at the end of the story, it was 1 o'clock in New York and it was time for these programs to go off. And he's saying, good night, Johnny. Good night, Jack. Good night, Merv. And then the curtain comes down. And what it was a transcript, in a sense, of a person trying to make connections with people through the television set, through a virtual society. And, the fastest growing addiction, as you probably know, in our time is internet addiction. And it says something about the spiritual and psychological isolation so many people feel, and that they're finding, sometimes in positive ways, sometimes not in positive ways, connection with people on the internet, distractions on the internet, fueling a fantasy on the internet. I mean, there are people who have fallen in love with total strangers on the internet, and it's a place where all the projections in human pathology can follow. No matter what the invention, you can expect the human psyche to show up and manifest in its familiar ways sooner or later.
Yes, well, that's certainly true. And then on the positive side, in the book, you talk about attitudes and behavior changes which support individuation and move us via the middle passage from misery to meaning. What would some of those kinds of new behaviors
be? I'm not going to say that everybody needs to be in therapy, but what I would say is everybody needs to have a thoughtful, informed conversation around the meaning of their own journey. Now, that sounds simple, but it's not. And it's almost like saying we all have an appointment to show up and be accountable for our lives, and not everybody, shows up for the appointment. And the question is, how does one go about having a very meaningful discussion, informed discussion, about what's going on here? Why do I do this or that? I mean, for example, we all would have places in our life where we see there are some patterns. You don't wake in the morning and say, while I'm brushing my teeth, I'm going to stare in the mirror and swear today I'm going to do the same stupid things I've done for a long time and expect it'll all work out well. Quite the contrary, but by day's end, we will have repeated some of our patterns. And the reason for that is that all of us carry these powerful internalized messages, some conscious, some unconscious. And that's what Jung meant by complexes. The complex is there because we have a history. And sometimes those messages are supportive and protective, and other times they are simply, reductive and repetitive. And, what the question is then, when I look at the patterns, I get some sense then of what's going on in the unconscious. What is it that makes me choose the same patterns? Why do I have my relationships turning out in the same old way? Where is it where I'm shooting myself in the foot? Where am I blocked by fear? As Jung said once, we all walk in shoes too small for us. Mm-hmm. And so what he meant by that metaphor was, we all live in adaptive, protective psychologies. That's understandable, but it keeps us locked in. It keeps us blocked. It keeps us stuck. And, whatever life is a mystery. The question is, how is it that I'm embracing that mystery, and how is it that I'm serving it, and how is it that I'm sort of growing up to be accountable to it? And, you know, the question is, how does a person have a conversation around the meaning of their own journey? And sometimes it's through reading books where people can offer us ideas that are constructive and helpful. Sometimes it's through friendship where we have people, hopefully, who are really friends and are willing to critique us and risk our displeasure. Sometimes we need to have a discussion with a third party who has certain training in some field, and that's where, you know, therapy can be very helpful. You know, I think, interestingly enough, one of the, changes that's happened in our culture is less and less is there a kind of condemnation with therapy or assumption that there's something radically wrong with people. The people I see are actually the people who are being responsible, the being most accountable, who are most thoughtful people, driven less by overt symptoms rather than really wanting to address where their relationships are going or what their career is about or what their dreams might be. And that kind of thoughtfulness, you see, is bound to lead one in a different direction over time. You know, there are three parts to this. First is the psychological part, and that is, can I get some insight into what's working within me? What are the search engines? What are the admonitions, the complexes within? Can I sort through them and bring some of them into consciousness? And then really come the moral qualities of the individual. The second is courage to face whatever the implications may be. And thirdly is persistence, you know, sticking something out over time until we actually come to a different place in our psyche. And that's how people change and grow.
Well, that's a great place for us to wrap up this part of our conversation. But before I let you go, I heard from Nancy Furlotti that you're heading up a program through Saybrook University, a kind of two-year Jungian studies program. Saybrook was actually... the original institution was founded by a couple of my colleagues. So tell us a little bit about that program and, what kind of qualifications a person might need to be involved in it and just a little about the structure of it.
Happy to do so. Saybrook University approached the Jung Center here in Houston about 4 years ago, and they said, you know, for a long time we've had programs here in humanistic and transpersonal psychology, and one of the pieces that's been missing here is really one of the fathers of that movement was really Carl Jung. And would you be able and willing to create a program for us in which we could engage in a partnership? And that's what we've done. And what I did was develop a philosophy, a structure, and recruit a faculty. And we're now in our third year of operation. And if anyone is interested, you can simply go to www.saybrook.edu and look under Jungian Studies. And what we have is really three programs in Jungian Studies. First of all is a fully credentialed, accredited master's degree in Jungian Psychology. Secondly, a doctoral program in Jungian Psychology. And thirdly, a certificate. For people who are interested simply for personal growth and development. And a certificate is a two-year study program. Now, for example, we have a Houston-based physician, age 65, who has been in the certificate program, and he's doing it simply as he looks to retirement and moving away from medicine, looking at, what are the things that I find interesting and stimulating that maybe I didn't have time and opportunity to look at in my life before, and this is an opportunity to do that. And so we're about to begin our third class. We have people moving through. We have people who are doing their master's thesis now, and then we have people heading towards their doctoral dissertations and so forth. So it's the only program in the world that's focused exclusively on the psychology of Jung and is an effort to provide an in-depth immersion in the primary works of Jung. And we meet in monthly seminars here in Houston. And students also take courses online for other requirements, such as ethics courses and history of psychology and that sort of thing. But the primary sort of educational encounter are the monthly seminars that we have throughout the winter months.
Well, I just know that some of my listeners' ears have really perked up, and I think there are going to be some inquiries coming forth as a result of this interview. So, Dr. James Hollis, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's my pleasure, and I appreciate the invitation to be with you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. James Hollis. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend the book we were discussing, The Middle Passage from Misery to Meaning in Midlife. It's not his most recent book. It has a copyright date of 1993. However, I've read other books about the midlife transition, and I have to say, this one struck me as the most powerful of the lot. He has a writing style that really flows, and it's richly illustrated with brief quotes from poetry, mythology, and other literature. I found that reading the book caused me to look at some of the patterns that have occurred in my own life and stimulated fresh personal discoveries and insights. The book is available in paperback, and it's only a bit over 100 pages, and I see it being sold on Amazon.com for about $9 US, so it's not likely to break your bank. Dr. Hollis does have a website, and you'll find it at www.jameshollis.net, and Hollis is spelled H-O-L-L-I-S. And the web address for Saybrook University is www.saybrook.edu, and Saybrook is spelled S-A-Y-B-R-O-O-K. If you type Jung into the search box on the site, you'll find the master's, doctoral, and certificate programs Dr. Hollis discussed. If you end up enrolling in any of these, let me know. By the way, I don't make any money from these recommendations. I'm just interested in providing you with good resources and tracking their impact.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Hello to all you Shrink Wrap Radio fans in over 70 countries. It's good to be here with you again. I've got a new interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Dr. Daniel Sonkin on parents' reactions to children leaving home. I've interviewed Dr. Sonkin previously on Wise Counsel about attachment theory and his And in this latest podcast, he applies theoretical constructs of attachment theory to the emotional issues faced by both parents and children around leaving home for college. His thinking along these lines was triggered by his only child, a daughter, leaving for college and the reactions her departure triggered in him, his daughter, and his therapist wife. If by any chance you're listening to this podcast and you're not subscribed, please do so. It costs you nothing, and it does help me to track how many listeners I have. For example, because of people who subscribed, I'm able to go to FeedBurner and see that I have listeners in over 70 countries, and I wouldn't have known that without those people having subscribed. Now, there's a link on our site which will help you to subscribe in iTunes. And let me remind you that you can find links to our Twitter, Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook fan page, and Yahoo discussion group in the right-hand sidebar on our site. I've also just added a couple of affiliate links in that same area that can both save you money and help to support the show. I'll bet just about everybody listening uses an inkjet printer, and you know how expensive printer ink can be. Well, you'll find a discount coupon on our site that will save you 10% at 4inkjets.com. That's the numeral 4 and inkjets.com. on their already low prices, and I feel good about advertising them because I use them myself. And you'll also find a coupon code to get 25% off a year's membership at Angie's List. If you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. That's one of the things that keeps us on the front page of their higher education shows. We've received a couple of new donations since the last show, and I want to thank those donors. You know who you are. And I want to thank those who've signed up on our site to make a monthly contribution. If you haven't taken this important step, let me challenge you to do so. Between Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel, you are receiving an hour or more per week of education and entertainment. Much work goes into tracking down this incredible and diverse array of guests, scheduling the interviews, conducting the interviews, editing the interviews, creating the other segments, and getting it all out to you. Plus, you have access to 6 years' worth of episodes, and most of them with transcripts. A $10 monthly subscription for 12 months would be $2.50 a week, less than the cost of coffee at Starbucks. So please join our cast of loyal supporters today by going to our site and clicking on the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And I thank you.
Hi, this is Sheena Iyengar, and I'm a faculty member at the Columbia Business School. I'm a social psychologist there and the author of The Art of Choosing. And I'm here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, that's Dr. Sheena Iyengar, Columbia University professor and author of The Art of Choosing, which is a perfect follow-on to our last show with Dan Ariely. And she will be my guest on the next show. Now let's take a dip into the old email bag. And lo and behold, the first one is a voice message left on our message line.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Lauren. I don't have the best phone voice, so people sometimes tell me they can't understand my messages well. I hope that you don't have that problem. Anyway, I'm an avid listener of your podcast and really appreciate all the work you do. And I was just listening to two of your recent podcasts about Jung, and you keep saying very many voicemails, and I'm driving a long way here and have some time on my hands, so I thought, you know, I'm going to call and leave a voicemail. And so besides wanting to say thanks for your work, I also was wondering if you had thought about doing a podcast or an interview with someone who might be involved with some of the new research that I hear has been going on around psilocybin and LSD and sort of a new interest in bringing perhaps treatments for depression, particularly in terminally ill patients, bringing the conversation around psychoactive drugs, you know, sort of thought of as only a part of the subculture now, bringing it back into the mainstream. In particular, I think there's a study going on at Johns Hopkins around, there's a clinical trial that's looking for participants who are terminally ill, and I think that's being psychoactive in a very controlled.
At this point, the call sort of faded out, but I definitely got the gist of it. Lauren, thanks so much for leaving me a voice message just when I was beginning to wonder if I was wasting my time announcing that message number at the end of every show. Thanks for being such an avid fan and for leaving that message. I like your suggestion of checking in with someone about a study at Johns Hopkins exploring psychedelic drugs in treating the terminally ill. In the meantime, I wonder if you've listened to my 2007 Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 78 with Are You Serious, a.k.a. Ken Goffman, about the legacy of Dr. Timothy Leary. You might want to check that one out. In the meantime, I think it might be time for me to revisit the therapeutic use of psychedelics. I've received another email from Peter B. Todd, my guest from episode number 240. Peter writes, "Dear David, it seems that Jonathan Shedler's courageous attempt to put psychoanalysis on the empirical map is beginning to create a significant, quotes, effect size, even in Australia. The Psychoanalytically Oriented Interest Group, POPIG, within the Australian Psychological Society, has invited Jonathan Shedler to be the keynote speaker and presenter at a conference scheduled for November 2010. How exciting. Peter goes on to say, This afternoon, I was invited to be a discussant and to present a paper on the operational analysis and measurement of unconscious intrapsychic processes and defense mechanisms in psychoanalytic research. I would like you to know that your podcasts, especially with Jonathan Shedler, have contributed to the evolution of a climate in which such a remarkable conference has become possible. I would like to recommend Dr. Timothy Keough, the current convener of POPIG, as a future guest for your podcast series. Dr. Keough has demonstrated tremendous tenacity given the dominance of cognitive behavioral therapy in Australia in working to make this conference happen, especially given the resistance to psychoanalysis in this country. Kind regards, Peter. Peter, thanks for that note, and I'm excited to hear that Jonathan Shedler, my guest from Shrink Wrap Radio number 236, will be a keynote speaker at that conference, and that my podcast has played some role in bringing that about. Thanks also for your recommendation of Dr. Keough as a future guest. Finally, here's one more from Lane, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I have recently come across your podcast and have been devouring interviews and am loving the guests you have interviewed and the variety of topics discussed. I'd like to say thank you for doing a great job and providing this valuable education to the masses. I also had a favor to ask in regards to a topic I'm very interested in learning more about, which is dreaming. I don't have any extensive background on the subject, but rather a great desire to learn more about this subject, the meaning of dreams, and building a foundation of knowledge to move forward with more specific subtopics as I learn more. Do you have any highly recommended books or authors on the subject of dreaming? Again, thank you very much for what you do. Keep up the good work. Regards, Lane. Lane, thanks for that. And I don't know if you've yet discovered the fact that I have a whole bunch of interviews on the topic of dreaming. Just type dream into the search box on the site, and you should be able to locate them all. I also wrote back to Lane recommending two books, Jeremy Taylor's Dream Work and Robert Johnson's Inner Work, in case any other listeners are interested in those recommendations. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone, just like Lauren did, at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Jungian analyst Dr. James Hollis for sharing his perspective on life's middle passage. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Columbia University professor Dr. Sheena Iyengar, whose first book is titled The Art of Choice. Among her many accomplishments, she's been a presenter at the TED Conference, and you can see her presentation at TED.com. She is a social psychologist who's also done work in the area of behavioral economics. So I look forward to sharing that interview with you. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.